Good afternoon. We're delighted to welcome with us students from Mid-State Technical College. Would they please stand? Greetings. Thank you for coming. And my understanding is that you are here for the lunch discussion. But you may be seated. Thank you. Students are here with a program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. We invite students from around the state to come and participate with us by hearing an oral argument. If the students come, they are given a summary of the case they are to hear with us and may engage in activities relating to the case. The discussion at lunch, which may involve students from a variety of schools, is on the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues. If counsel missed that today, we do it almost every day, and you're welcome to come and listen. Let me introduce the court to all of you. Starting on my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. And to her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductory remarks made, I'll call our last case for today, 08AP1296 CR State v. Janet Connor. I always ask, is there a screen visible to the audience? There is. Okay, fine. Is there anyone in the audience who would like a summary of this case? Doesn't have it. If you raise your hand, we'll give you a summary. All right. There will be a 25-minute argument by Stephen E. Mays, and you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Mays. You may proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Stephen Mays, and I represent the petitioner in this matter, Janet Connor. The issues raised in this case are, number one, one's due process right to notice of the charge, and two, the meaning of Wisconsin Statute 940.32, sub 2M, sub B. With regard to the notice issue, it's more clearly stated as follows. What degree of specificity is required in charging dates of alleged conduct in a criminal complaint to satisfy one's constitutional due process right to notice of the charged offense? Meaning, in this particular case, was Janet Connor deprived of her due process right to notice of the offense charged?
Counselor, does that have to be in the information, or is the complaint sufficient since it is what the initial charging document here?
I would submit it's generally one and the same. So initially the complaint and then following a bind over in the information?
I guess my question was, if it's sufficient in the complaint, what does that do to your notice argument if the information is less complete?
If it is sufficient within the complaint, it eliminates it.
Okay, that's all I need to know. Thank you.
And I do want to come back to this notice issue momentarily because I think it'll be much clearer after we look at the meaning, then, of 940.32, sub 2M, sub B. The question, then, is must the present violation occur after the operative prior conviction in order to establish a violation of the aggravated stalking statute? The Court of Appeals found that this statute was ambiguous. They found that, stating that it's capable, a statute is ambiguous, and this one was, when it's capable of being understood in two or more different senses by reasonably well-informed persons. However, this court has held numerous times, and I cite State versus Cedegord for that reason, that a statute is not rendered ambiguous merely because the parties disagree as to its meaning. In this case, the parties absolutely disagree as to its meaning. The state agrees with the Court of Appeals' conclusion that the 7-year time restriction in 2MB requires that only the final act charged as part of a course of conduct occur within 7 years of the prior conviction, without any temporal restriction on the other acts establishing the underlying course of conduct. However, both the state and the Court of Appeals in reaching that conclusion have ignored the plain language of the statute. The Court of Appeals ignored the plain language of present violation language in 2MB and instead focused on the course of conduct language in 2M. Obviously, they interplay, but I submit they ignored that reading. When charged together to create this aggravated statute of stalking, as in this case, to then enhance a Class I felony to a Class H felony and increase the penalty from 3.5 years to a possible 6 years, 2MB, sub 2M, sub B, becomes an element of the substantive offense under sub 2. This court had made that finding in Warbelton. The substantive offense under sub 2 involves the actor intentionally engaging in a course of conduct directed at a specific person. That's the operative language here. Course of conduct under sub 2 means a series of two or more acts carried out over time, however short or long, that show a continuity of purpose. And then it goes on and it lists 10 acts. I submit that when that element then is added to the 2MB language, the charge is elevated. It's aggravated. That is when the fixed temporal element comes into play. The limitation is clearly stated in sub 2M, sub B. The present violation must occur within 7 years after the prior conviction. To not read it that way would lead to absurd results. The legislature's intent is expressed in words it used, and statutory language is to be interpreted to avoid absurd or unreasonable results.
I'm not sure I understand all this. The present violation has to be within the 7-year period of the prior conviction, right?
Has to be within 7 years after.
Okay.
And, if I may, that present violation consists of two or more acts making up...
Let's just take one thing at a time.
Sure.
The present violation here, what date is that?
November 30, 2005.
November 30, 2005. And one was the prior conviction?
2003.
Okay. So at first blush, we're in the 7-year period, right? Okay. So what's the matter? What are you complaining about, precisely?
Well,
I understand course of conduct is two or more acts. I think you're complaining about the course of conduct. What are the acts within the course of conduct?
The state alleged them to be maintaining a visual or physical proximity to the victim, approaching or confronting the victim, and placing an object on or delivering an object to property owned, leased, or occupied by the victim.
What were the dates of those?
November 30, 2005.
Each occurred on November 30, 2005?
True. And, okay. And I'm the one who requested this obnoxious visual display. But the reason
you'll have to stand next to the microphone, otherwise we don't record you. All right.
The reason I asked for that is, as you can see, the criminal complaint, the information is exactly the same, as Justice Rogenczak mentioned. It's been filed on December 7, 2005, and it alleges as I've highlighted, on or about Wednesday, November 30, 2005. Mm-hmm. The state continued along that theory up to and through trial. What I've submitted there is the actual jury instruction that they submitted to the state, filed 2 years later, June 4, 2007. And in that, the prosecutor handwrote in maintaining a visual or physical proximity to the victim or confronting the victim or placing an object on property owned by the victim. All along, the state and the petitioner, oddly as it may seem, were probably the only two on the same page. It was when the trial court changed the rules. The trial court, strike that, the petitioner only learned at the close of proof at trial at the jury instruction conference that the allegation of November 30, 2005 was now not the only significant date in question. At that point, the petitioner, the evidence was closed, and there was no way for the petitioner to go about trying to prove or disprove those offenses.
Well, what were the new offenses? What else is there in this case other than those November 30th?
There are three charges, two counts of stalking, which consist of the present violation in the course of conduct, and there was a criminal damage to property charge. My submission is that the state believed that the stalking offense was the present violation, and that stalking present violation itself consists of a course of conduct. It's an extremely convoluted statute, but convolution does not make it ambiguous. If one takes and reads the plain reading of that statute, one can see that it requires basically three parts. The actor has a previous conviction for a crime. Dictionary.com says previous means coming or occurring before something else, prior to. That then, in the context of this case, would require the previous conviction for a crime to occur before the present violation. Present violation, then, part two, and the state has argued in its brief that the petitioner doesn't state what the present violation was. I was inferring that that was what people knew all along. The present violation was what was alleged on or about November 30, 2005. Not only did they allege a particular day of the week, a particular month, day, and year, the only other thing they could have done was to put at 2:55 p.m.
Counselor, as I look at the complaint, and I have it in my notebook here, if you look at page 2 of the complaint, in the last paragraph, it incorporates into the complaint the police report and also a motion to introduce other acts evidence, both of which it is using to establish the course of conduct. So I guess I don't know why all of those other acts, which are recounted in the many pages attached to the criminal complaint, shouldn't be considered by us as to whether there was proper notice. Can you address that, please?
I'd be happy to, Your Honor. When we received it, and I'm certain that your complaint is the same as mine that has that particular day, November 30, 2005, was what was alleged. They alleged this act to have taken place, or these acts to have taken place. Stalking, which consists of two or more acts, and criminal damage to property. The petitioner prepared a defense to allegations on or about November 30, 2005. The state did not charge this as a continuing offense. In fact, the state then brought that motion to admit those acts, which are attached at length to the criminal complaint, to show This is how this gal operates. This is her MO. We're bringing these to show her identity. We're bringing these to show her motives. However, and I hope this addresses the question, had the state intended to charge the petitioner, as people want to, I think, read this statute, with the continuing offense, which they did not, spanning a 5-year period and encompassing all the events listed in their 404 motion, there would have been no need to seek admission of those acts under 904.042. They simply would have been admitted and admissible as the charged course of conduct of a continuing offense. A defendant's due process rights are violated when the information does not contain the time frame for which a defendant is prosecuted for a continuing offense. If all along what they were doing was alleging a continuing offense, by charging a single commission date, they certainly didn't give us notice of that, certainly didn't give me an opportunity to prove what now the trial court is saying is an element of this offense. Because not only do you need to defend, Mr. Mays, the on or about November 30, 2005 allegations, all three listed in the complaint, but you got to go back and you got to come up with some kind of a defense to why she was making harassing phone calls, why she was alleged to have put glue in his locks, why she was alleged to have smashed his windshield. Many trials. That's just simply the danger, and one we have to accept as defense attorneys, of the admission of these kinds of acts to show the double-edged side of that sword, to show motive, intent, opportunity, absence of mistake, modus operandi.
Mr. Mays, let me interrupt you for a minute, if I might. I'm troubled by your argument because, first of all, when you look at the statute clearly has been set forth both in the complaint and the information. It talks about a course of conduct. That ought to send some kind of signal to your client and to your client's counsel. In addition to that, we've got the Warbleton case, which goes back and looks at the development of stalking statutes throughout the country and talks about the legislative history of the statute in Wisconsin and in other places, and talks about a continuum that could be used to intervene at various stages. Now, if that doesn't say to your client and your client's counsel that other acts occurring between the conviction and the specific acts charged on November 30th are appropriate to bring in, I don't know what does. And as Justice Rogensack pointed out, you've got all of the attachments to the complaint detailing these things, including the motion, which was a motion to bring in other acts evidence. Now, I understand that the court during the course of the trial said, okay, maybe it was more than other acts evidence. Maybe it's evidence that goes directly to this continuity or continuum of acts and allowed it on that basis as well. How does that not give your client and your client's counsel notice of what's going to go on?
It certainly gives us notice that those are going to become an issue. It gave me more notice that those are going to become an issue when they brought then their motion under 904.042 as, and then the court admitted that stuff as other acts. I didn't have notice, and Your Honor said, during the course of trial, evidence closed. We're at the jury instructions. Guys, what do these mean? Well, Mr. Sharp gave me his clear understanding of what they meant from start to finish. On or about November 30th, there were some allegations. That criminal complaint, as Justice Rogensack indicated, had some attachments, police report, etc. All it talked about and in terms of that date were three allegations. She maintained visual, she approached, and she scratched the car. So, hopefully to answer your question, if all of that comes in and is then used against her. It should be to convict her for the present violation. But we're not just trying to convict her of the present violation. We're trying to enhance the penalty for that conviction. That's where the notice is an issue throughout, but that's where the notice is even more of an issue, when I don't know that they're going to go and try and prove as an element acts beyond November or prior to November 30, 2005 for purposes of proving her guilty of the present violation. So, I have noticed...
The present violation or for the enhancement?
The present violation as calling for the enhanced enhancement, yes.
Because it's just added an element. It's all of the elements of the offense plus... This,
as you eloquently stated in Warbelton, yes, as this court stated in Warbelton.
Now, the complaint attaches the police report, and you say the police report does not have anything other than the three allegations relating to November 30th. Is that your point?
The police report outlined the acts that occurred on the date alleged, November 30, 2005.
Okay.
That Mr. Gaynor came out of the post office.
So. Now, it's my understanding that at trial, the other acts was let in. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
So, one...
Prior to trial.
Pardon me?
Prior to trial, as other acts.
Right. Now, at trial, did the jury hear that James and Connor had been involved in a brief relationship that ended in May 2000?
Yes.
That Connor began calling James in the first week of July 2000.
Yes.
That Connor entered James' homes on October 4, 2000. I'm reading right from the state's brief, page 23.
I believe they heard that, yes.
That October 5, 2000, Connor and his sister came to James' property and got into an argument with James.
I believe that was...
Well, what I'm getting at is, and I'm still on page 23, 24, 25, the jury heard a lot about what happened in 2000 and 2001, which related to the prior conviction of 2003, right?
Yes.
And I'm assuming that you're objecting to bringing in anything that related to events prior to the 2003 conviction. Are you objecting to that? I'm trying to find out what your objection is.
My objection is not that it came in, although I made an objection throughout to the 404 incidences that you pointed out coming in. My objection became... when the court then, after the evidence was closed, made it an element that I had to then address. Lots of times trial strategy is such that you address the allegation charged, and I was addressing on November 30, 2005. I didn't know till the court, trial court, made those acts an element by allowing it to span a five-year period versus the however long period it was on November 30, 2005. So, I didn't call witnesses. I didn't have Ms. Connor testify to those things. They came in, and when they're 404 acts, lots of times you don't give them as much of a focus because it's not something that you needed to disprove.
Did he give a limiting instruction since he brought him in under 404?
There was discussion, and I'm sorry, I don't recall exactly if 275 was given. I know that in rereading the transcript, the discussion of 275 was given. I do believe it was, which is even more of a confusion, quite honestly, for the jury.
Without these acts of 2000 and 2001, could your client be found guilty of felony H?
I don't know how. She was acquitted of the criminal damage to property. What they could, and acquitted of the second count stalking Rhonda Gaynor. In theory, they could have convicted her of the stalking by maintaining visual and approaching. But I don't believe the way the evidence came out, that that was what they decided. And I know you don't want to hear what I talked to them about afterward.
I want to know if they convict her of a visual and or physical or approaching. And she's already had another conviction within 7 years. Why isn't that an H felony?
Certainly they could have. It made it a heck of a lot easier for them to do that, hearing all this stuff.
I have another question for you. On page 31 of your brief, you talk about the Holsom case, and it says, in order to determine the sufficiency of the charge, two factors are considered. They are whether the accusation is such that the defendant determined whether it states an offense to which he is able to plead and prepare a defense. Now, your argument is yes as to November 30th.
True.
Right? But then it says, and whether conviction or acquittal is a bar to another prosecution for the same offense. And that's a double jeopardy kind of argument, which you don't elaborate on.
I didn't, because I didn't believe that that was germane to this particular issue. It was just something stated in that case.
Yeah, well, he, as I understand it, there was at least an accusation somewhere that she keyed the car in January of 05, right?
Yes. Not maybe January of 05, yes.
Before the November 30th,
certainly.
Which is what I'm driving at. So what I want to know is, can the state bring another charge against her for the January offense?
Absolutely, if they can prove it. And you know what? It would be a Class I, because it's not a continuous course of conduct.
So they can bring in all the stuff that she did as other acts evidence.
If they're going to try and elevate it.
Elevate it in your trial, and they could then prosecute for the same offense.
They could charge each one of those as individual single offenses, or, as I submit they probably should have done here, they could charge on or about 2000 through November 30th, 2005. Then I'm not here standing before you arguing about this. I'm on notice. I'm arguing 2MB and the meaning, but I am not arguing that I didn't have notice. I was on notice.
What worries me, if the charge really is this course of conduct, and they bring in all this evidence under other acts, and then you tell me that they can, the state can charge each of these offenses separately. That, I mean, I'm concerned about that on the double jeopardy issue, but haven't thought it through.
I notice my time's up. My only comment would be, as am I.
Thank you, counsel. Yes, Justice Prosser.
On November 30th, did the alleged victims see the defendant? Did they testify they saw the defendant?
They testified that they saw her. Yes, they did not testify they saw her key the car, which would be the third of those three acts. They testified they saw her behind, near or behind the vehicle.
Did her statement, her call to the police department come in?
She made a call to the police the next day to report some contact with them, and that they would probably be calling to report that she damaged the vehicle.
Okay. But didn't she say that she had seen them that day?
I believe she did make that in her call, yes.
And did that come in as evidence?
Yep.
And if that came in as evidence, didn't she say she confronted them that day?
I don't believe she said she confronted them. I believe the testimony was that Jim Gaynor confronted me, and then there was exchange. So was that her meeting number two of the acts by confronting? Jury question.
I mean, didn't she say she shouted at them?
Yes, she did shout back at them.
That's not confronting them?
I suppose it's confronting after there's some interaction going on. I take confront to mean I'm going to instigate the contact with you. I confronted you, or maybe I confronted in response to your contact with me. Again, interpretation.
I want to make sure I understand this. Are you saying that on the way that this case was charged, that all events in the course of conduct should have occurred on November 30th?
As pursuant to how they charged it, yes, sir.
And course of conduct means a series of two or more acts?
However short or long.
Okay, so if she says she saw them, and they say they saw her, and that there was confrontation, isn't that two things according to the statute?
Well, it's one, maintaining a visual. I believe that's interpreted as kind of scoping out, but if you're saying there were two acts of confronting.
How did she happen to be there?
Well, again, I noticed my time is up and I have
to answer the question. You should answer the question, please.
Thank you. She happened to be there because Mr. Gaynor was an employee at the post office, and as Justice Bradley may know, in Richland Center, the library is right next door. She was returning an overdue book, and she came walking straight from the library past what was his car, and then apparently saw him come out of the post office. That's when he saw her down the road by the vehicle and ran running toward her, saying, "Hey, wait, wait." And that's when the allegation of keying came about.
Now, the jury didn't convict her of keying.
No, sir.
Multiple places on the car.
Almost every side of the vehicle but the hood. Were the allegations, and no, sir, they acquitted her of that.
And what did the complainants, did they testify that they saw her doing that?
Saw her running alongside the passenger side, running along and hiding down back behind the back, and then running along the close to the passenger side. Driver's side.
So their cars had been keyed in the past, hadn't they? Isn't that true?
Numerous times.
Numerous times. But if she didn't do it on November 30th, somebody else probably did it. Is that right? They're running around, potential keyers running around.
Well, not necessarily. I don't think the jury believed that the car was keyed that day, and the investigation was quite subpar, if you will, that they weren't, I don't believe, able to show that adequately. Not fresh damage.
But could a jury have taken this physical proximity and the visuals and the confrontation and found those things, at least?
I suppose, but it made it much easier when they knew all the other times that had allegedly, but uncharged, events had occurred. There are no other questions.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Assistant Attorney General Warren D. Weinstein.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Warren Weinstein. I'm Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin, representing the State of Wisconsin in this action. The first thing I want to make clear, because it seemed to me that there was maybe a mistaken impression that the incorporated motion for other acts was in this criminal case. It was not. It was in the injunction action for harassment. And therefore, all of those acts, unless the court backs away from the Court of Appeals view that you can incorporate things into the complaint by reference, all of the acts back to 2000 were part of the complaint. It is true, and probably would have been better practice, had in the first line the reference would have been to a period rather than a specific date. That date that's referenced is the last act in the course of conduct in the state's view.
Okay. That's on page 22 of your brief.
Right.
The complaint states, is the attached police reports, the property crime non-assessment statement, do they generally relate just to November 30th?
The incorporated documents didn't include November 30.
Pardon me? Did or did not?
I'm sorry?
These
incorporated documents, the other crimes, did not include the November 30th incident. The police report did.
Okay. That's all November 30th until you get to your bold statement. Is that right? I'm looking at the bottom of 22.
I'm sorry?
I'm looking at the bottom of page 22.
Right.
Where you make reference to the complaint. The unbold four lines there do not refer to anything but November 30th. That is the attached police reports and the property crime non-consent statement. Okay? Am I wrong?
Oh, the property crime non-consent statement, yes, that was
November 30th.
Yeah, that was a single sheet. It didn't really say much of anything.
All right. Now, here's where you say you've incorporated things before November 30th, right?
The other acts were all
the factual basis. The factual basis contained in the attached motion to introduce evidence, all of which are incorporated into this complaint.
That's right. And those went back all the way to 2000.
Were they the motion made in this case?
No.
No.
It was made in
the
injunction harassment case.
Got different ones on it.
And the violation of the injunction, which was this evidence successfully demonstrated harassment, an injunction issued, and the prior conviction was for violating the injunction. And all that was testified to at the preliminary hearing also. So that was all before the instruction conference. Mr. Daner testified at the preliminary hearing about his relationship in 2000, harassment restraining order, the prank phone calls that began in October of 2000. He'd been called at work several times. I guess I just can't buy that the present violation can be separated from the course of conduct when you have to prove a course of conduct to prove any violation at all. It seems to me that the present violation is the course of conduct that the state charges in the charging documents. And in my view, the charging documents charged acts beginning in 2000 and proceeding up and including November 30 of 2005. That's the present violation. Now, because that period straddled the conviction for harassing, that is what presents the question of whether or not you have to establish a new course of conduct, if you will, after the violation, after the conviction. But actually, there were acts testified to at trial that were after the violation, after the conviction, and before the November 30 violation. So even under Mr. May's view of the facts, there were sufficient facts in this case. I think, however, to hold that a new course of conduct has to be established, even two or more acts, you run smack into the problem of the legislature's language in the statute that requires the circumstances of the victim to be taken into account on whether or not there's emotional or other damage to the victim. And that's in the jury instruction. It has to be to determine whether the element of course of conduct is established. The standard is what effect the course of conduct would have on a person of ordinary intelligence and imprudence in the position of, in this case, James Gaynor, under the circumstances that existed at the time of the course of conduct. So if the 2000 acts all were a continuous course of conduct for purposes of the statute, it seems to me Mr. Mays' interpretation of the statute ends up truncating part of the evidence the legislature intended as proving the course of conduct and assessing the circumstances of the victim.
Counsel, help me with this statute, and I'm referring to 2MB and the very last part of 2MB after, and it says, and the present violation occurs within 7 years after the prior conviction. So the present violation, as I understand the argument, is the course of conduct from the year 2000 to November 30th, 2005.
Right.
There's something that just, you know, causes me to pause. It just doesn't seem to make sense. Let me read it again. And the present violation, and I'll say parenthetically, which is a course of conduct from 2000 to 2005, occurs within 7 years after the prior conviction, which is 2003. How can, it's only by counting the last date of the course of conduct that you can meet this. I mean, that's the rub here, apparently. In other words, the things that are detailed on pages 23 and 24, if I'm correct, of your brief that talk about the problems in 2000 and 2001, and there's lots of stuff there that led up to the 2003 conviction. Obviously, they occurred before 2003. Why is this so obtuse?
In my view, if some of the course of conduct, at least one act, occurs after the triggering event, whatever that happens to be, and there are a number of them in the statute, then the course of, then the present, and the, and that's what's charged, then the present violation occurs after the conviction, and one looks at when the last element or the last act charged or the course of conduct.
The last act of the course of conduct for which violation is.
Yeah. That Tums case is a good way, I think, to illustrate it, because in that case, the triggering event is a single act that occurred on a specific day. So in his case, it was the use of a dangerous weapon in the course of conduct. So the enhanced offense would not be completed until he actually used that dangerous weapon. But because of the word after in this statute, that course of conduct, if it terminated at the use of the dangerous weapon, wouldn't comply with the statute because there's no part of the course of conduct after the use of the dangerous weapon. But in that case, the prosecutor didn't charge the aggravated stalking until he had done an additional act. So then we had the use of the dangerous weapon within the course of conduct, and we had at least one act after the use of the dangerous weapon. In my view, that complies with the statute.
Where do you find in the statute the argument that the course of conduct is defined by the last act of the course of conduct?
Well, I think the Tums case is the case that really, although that's not, that doesn't deal with our issue directly, what that deals with is how do you sentence? Because that course of conduct occurred both before and after TIS 1 and TIS 2. It began in TIS 1 and it terminated in TIS 2. So the Court of Appeals in that case had to determine when was the crime completed and which sentencing structure was the applicable one. And what they said was the crime was not a completed aggravated crime until the use of the dangerous weapon, and that occurred after the change in the statute for sentencing. Therefore, the new sentencing one was the one that applied. And I think the same reasoning applies here. Now, the problem is, and I disagree with Mr. Mays on this, I don't see how in this kind of a statute you can say this is not a continuing offense. By definition, it's a continuing offense because the course of conduct requires at least two acts. It's not like other crimes where you have a series of acts that can be charged either as individual crimes or as a criminal activity in one crime. This, by its definition, is the latter situation.
Okay, I'm going to try it a different way and tell you how I would interpret this statute, just reading it. I would interpret this statute to mean, first, just because I confront someone one time isn't stalking. By stalking, in the ordinary common parlance, you mean repeated kind of events, right?
I agree.
All right.
And I think that's what the statute provides.
That's right. I do, too. I agree with you. That's why the statute says you got to have a course of conduct to mean stalking, right?
Right.
So if I'm going to bring a charge against Dave Prosser for stalking, I've got to have not one incident of stalking, not one incident of, just for the point of this, irritating me. I've got to have two, at least two. So for Dave Prosser to be convicted of stalking in 2003, I got to show two incidents at least.
Right.
And they set forth 1 through 10 in the statutes. I've got to fit one of them in, right?
I'm sorry?
I've got to fit two of the incidents into 1 through 10 in the statutes, which define, including any of the following.
I don't think this is exclusive, but generally speaking.
I'm going to make it clear. All right. So now I got them on one violation of stalking. Now, after my 2003 conviction that I have managed to get, he persists in the conduct, and I'm going to go to the state and ask you to prosecute him again, right? So now we have a new stalking, right?
Right.
And we're back to where we were. I got to show two incidents, right? Because I got to show a course of conduct, right?
Yes, you have to have two incidents
right.
for the course of conduct.
Right. So it seems to me that course of conduct should be after the 2003 conviction. Now, I'm not talking about the enhancement. I'm just talking about straight stalking. I've already got him clipped for everything he did before 2003.
Except that her conviction wasn't a prior stalking conviction. It was a violation of a harassing injunction. So,
I understand
as with a conviction for bodily injury, the conviction can be part of the course of conduct.
Because B says the actor has a previous conviction for a crime. It could be spitting.
That's right. It does not have to be stalking.
That's right. Okay. The victim is the victim of the present violation. So the present violation in my case against Prosser, the present violation is something that would have happened, according to this complaint, November 30th. And I know you've included other things. It seems to me the present violation is what he has done in stalking. And in my example, he's already been clipped for stalking. So in this case where he's been clipped for stalking, I think under the words of B, the present violation has to be for acts after his prior conviction for stalking.
I would only
And that this second conviction has to be within 7 years, that is, 7 years after his prior conviction.
I would agree with that only if the first conviction is for stalking.
Okay, I'm taking you up slowly. So we agree on at least if it's two for stalking. Okay.
If it's two stalking convictions,
right.
And the reason is because then you do run into a double jeopardy problem if you don't separate the first stalking conviction, which relied on all those prior acts. That doesn't mean those prior acts aren't admissible in the second trial, but it
only
does.
For motive, plan, blob, intent, etc.
Prove an element of the crime, because the course, even though you may have been convicted of that, and you're not able to be convicted of that course of conduct again, the course of conduct can still be a continuum, including that first course of conduct. I don't think the legislature intended, and if you go through the Blockberger test, you do not come up with the same offense because you've got evidence of different acts. And once you get past the Blockberger test, the whole question becomes a legislative intent. And I don't think the legislature intended to keep that first course of conduct out of the evidence when they specifically provided that the jury has to assess the circumstances.
Begins at the microphone.
That when the jury has to assess the circumstances of the victim, which includes both convictions. I mean, how much more intimidating is it when someone continues stalking after they've already been convicted of stalking?
Right. I've got you to where at least we agree if the two crimes are stalking, right?
Right.
All right.
If the two crimes are stalking, I think you do have to have at least two acts after the first conviction.
Okay, good. Now, in this one, we do not have a conviction of stalking.
We don't have a conviction for stalking.
Okay. So there you say on the present violation for stalking, you can go back because you don't have a prior conviction.
I think in that kind of a case and in this kind of a case, the conviction is part of the course of conduct. And there's nothing in the double jeopardy jurisprudence that would prohibit that. And so it is part of the same offense, just like in our firearms crime, we have an aggravated felon in possession of firearms, we have an aggravated offense when the person has previously been convicted of the same possession of a firearm. That's an element of the crime. You put in evidence of it. You're not convicting him of the first one over again, but it's evidence of an element of the crime for conviction of the second offense, and that's what we have here.
If you're right, and then you gave him notice by incorporating the injunction and other materials. This complaint is 21 pages long, and it includes a brief in the prior case. I think it's the prior case, setting forth a lot of stuff, and you just incorporated the whole bag of 21 pages of it. So let us say that was adequate notice. I would say that you have that. If that was adequate notice, and that's what you're charging, this course of conduct, then why do you bring a motion for other acts evidence? It's inconsistent to me.
I don't know the answer to that, and I can only surmise that the DA did not understand this. The way
case,
I do
or
now.
The way it is. That's what I surmise, too.
This
it
is
doesn't
difficult.
Make sense.
This is difficult. You know.
I agree.
Yeah. I said obtuse before, but I roll my eyes.
I do think.
I'm questioning you about this, and why I'm asking you about the crime is that otherwise what the court obviously should not do if they agree with you is to write an opinion that affects all stalking and second stalking, because this first crime was not stalking. This is a very special circumstance.
I'm sorry.
It's a special case because the first was not, we don't have a conviction of stalking two times. The first was not a stalking.
Yeah.
Therefore, any opinion in this case only covers where the first crime is not stalking.
Well, I still think, while you have to distinguish between the two crimes, and you have to establish a course of conduct after for double jeopardy purposes, I still think all that evidence comes in to establish the circumstances surrounding the victim, and also because we're talking about a continuum, the state's entitled to put in the entire course of conduct, even if part of it is prohibited from conviction.
If I understand you right, then there would have to be some perhaps kind of limiting instruction for the jury, because if you've had a stalking conviction, obviously what's labeled here as other acts evidence would be coming in to prove that stalking conviction. So if you're going to say it's a continuum that runs through convictions, regardless of what the convictions are, and you can bring in the same evidence again, you'd have to be bringing it in for motive or opportunity or some other thing.
I think it would be wise to have an instruction that says this evidence comes in to establish the circumstances surrounding the reasonableness of the victim's intimidation, and which is kind of the way we do with other acts evidence now.
So if I understand you, you're saying if the prior conviction here had been for stalking rather than violation of the injunction, that there would have had to have been two intervening acts within a 7-year period before this crime could be charged as it has been here.
If the first conviction had been stalking, yes. Mm-hmm. But there were. I mean, Mr. Gaynor testified that there were hang-up phone calls in October of 2005, and also testified that while Ms. Connor was in jail on unrelated offenses, he got no hang-up calls. So there were certainly circumstantial evidence to identify her as the hang-up caller.
Thank you.
Counsel, when I read this in preparation, I was thinking of the prior or the previous conviction being a conviction for stalking. I mean, I was just thinking of that. And so let me put in, let's say bad check. Someone gives me a bad check, and I'm the victim of that bad check. And so that's the crime, that's the previous conviction here. Does this make sense then? I mean, what I'm trying to find is a crime that really would be where there would be a victim, but it would be unrelated to any kind of stalking activity as set forth in the statute. And a bad check just comes to mind, but there might be a better example, something that's totally unrelated to it, that has a victim, and then that same victim becomes is subject to stalking behavior. So here, let me read the statute then. The actor has a previous conviction for writing a bad check to Jane Doe, the victim. The victim of that crime is the victim of the present violation, which is 2000 to 2005 activities that would come within the course of conduct definition of stalking. And the present violation, the 2000 to 2005 activities that come within the course of conduct, occurs within 7 years after the bad check writing conviction. Now, this is just complex.
Well, I think the language of the statute would indicate that could be charged that way. I guess we'll have to wait for the case to come up to see whether or not that's really an absurd result or not.
Yeah, but you're suggesting, and the dialogue here was that a crime is, a crime, any crime, pick a crime. As long as there's a victim with the crime, then this comes into play.
Well, I guess it would kind of, in terms of making logical sense, it would depend on whether or not that crime was in furtherance of intimidating the victim or not. Mm-hmm. But
it's not required.
But it's not required. You're right.
The
language
doesn't
have
any
limitation at all. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
How did Ms. Connor stalk the victim on November 30th?
Well, the state's theory was that she keyed the car, and as I read the testimony and the complaint, that was the sole act on that. I didn't have the benefit of Mr. Sharpe's written in instruction. But so I was under the impression that the keying of the car and everything that went on in relation to that confrontation was a single act, and that the course of conduct was all of the stuff, the hang-up calls, the prior keyings, the breaking of his windshield, the glue in his door handles, all of that stuff. All of that, appeared to me from the trial transcripts to be the course of conduct.
But the defendant was found not guilty of keying.
And there was some concern about the identification of that aspect. But certainly there was other testimony of other acts that occurred in November, not on November 30th, from which a jury could have found, even rejecting everything that happened on November 30th, could have still found a course of conduct, including acts after the conviction.
The incidents that are outlined in your brief, and I think are related to, on page 23-25 of your brief, what else happened besides hang-up calls in October 2005 that was actually put into evidence between the three convictions in 2003 and November 30th?
According to James's trial testimony, his car got keyed after the conviction and before. Once in December of 2004, and once prior to that, there were escalating phone calls in 2000. This is on roughly page 166 through 170 of, I can't remember the record number. It's I think it's the first day of trial. Escalating phone calls in 2005, which were being placed from calling cards. Also calls to Rhonda's parents. That's, of course, not a part of that wasn't a part of the charge, but certainly meant to intimidate both of them. And, of course, although they acquitted, the state attempted to prove stalking against Rhonda also. And those were eventually traced to the same calling cards, although with calling cards you can't tell who's making the calls. That's why I think the discontinuing of any calls during the time that Ms. Connor was incarcerated becomes important. She was in jail on something other than anything involving this case in June of 2003. I'm sorry, October of 2003 through February of 2004, she was in jail on something unrelated to either the injunction violation or the stalking. I don't know what it was. There was also a question the court asked. I see my red light's on. But there was there was another access instruction given, but there was also evidence of a keying incident to a unrelated third party. So regardless of how one views the stalking evidence, that instruction should have been given.
Thank you, Mr. Weinstein. Mr. Mays, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Mr. Mays, I thought I understood in your original argument that you were contending that all of those things going back to 2000 shouldn't have come in to supply any evidence, but that other things could come in. And counsel has just outlined other things that could come in.
And other things that did come in. And that's the problem I have with one of counsel's last statement. Without regard to the incidents on November 30th, 2005, the jury could still convict the defendant on the other acts. That's exactly what happened. And evidence of why that happened is because she was acquitted of the criminal damage to property. So when a person gets a thick complaint that attaches a 404 motion from another case, and it's incorporated by reference, here to in, here for, all that, but then the charge is on or about this day, and that 404 motion is brought, argued, and granted admissibility on identity, on motive, on modus operandi. Again, the petitioner's on notice that that's coming in as the other acts, not as the element of the aggravated offense of stalking. And consequently, when that element then is added by the court after the evidence is closed, how can I not be disadvantaged? Because I'm not able to argue those things. Incidentally, counsel indicated that there were some other things that came in, calling Rhonda's parents. Well, that's not part of the charge, but that all came in if she's acquitted of the criminal damage to property. And the state has charged on or about this date, and the state submits its jury instruction 2 years later and lists those three incidents. Didn't list harassing phone calls. Didn't list showing up at the employer's work or home, things like that. Listed maintaining visual contact. Listed confronting or approaching. And listed placing an object, keying. A person defends the charges that are there. The court, believing this gives context to and shows a background between them two, and admits it as 404 months before the trial, and then on the day of the final trial, right before we're about to argue to the jury, says, no, 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 my theory of the state's case is this. It all comes in. It's fair game. And then, not only then does the state take that information, but then it takes and argues things that are completely unrelated to what happened on the date charged, November 30, 2005. There is no question. This statute isn't the easiest reading statute. Why? Because it has to take into play, what comes into play is another statute and the interplay of those. But that happens all the time. And because two parties, maybe more, disagree as to its meaning, it doesn't make it ambiguous. But let me just address, if in fact you find that it is ambiguous, what the legislature's intent was, because that was addressed. Did the legislature intend sub 2M, sub B, to require the present violation, i.e., two or more acts constituting a course of conduct, to occur after? The answer to that, because as this court stated in Warbelton, the legislature is entrusted to define the elements of the crime and to prescribe punishments for each crime. Quite simply, the answer is yes. Here's why. It's aggravated. It seeks to increase the consequences for those who have already been punished for a crime against the same victim and who have not learned their lesson.
Your argument is the same whether the prior offense was stalking or bad check.
My argument, if the prior offense is stalking, then you've got a whole slew of double jeopardy issues that came up.
But your argument is really the same, whether it's stalking or something else.
Yes, it is.
Okay. And I have another question. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I will. The complaint would have alleged acts between 2000 and 2003. Or even before 2003, because that's when the conviction was 2003.
Would have alleged a continuing offense.
Up to 2003.
Okay.
But you got notice of that. arguably. All right. But at trial, evidence was brought in about 2004 incidents and 2005 incidents. You didn't get notice of that.
True.
I'm just trying to clarify what you got notice about and what you didn't get notice about. All right.
Yeah.
We were now on what the legislative intended. You got a minute to finish up.
Thank you. I'll put it simply. After there's been a conviction and the state seeks to aggravate, enhance the sentence, if they can't find two or more acts to constitute a course of conduct after the previous conviction against the same victim, then the person hasn't committed the offense of stalking such that it should be aggravated and enhanced. They may have committed one, and it may have been against that same victim, but then they've committed that one offense against that victim. But if they haven't committed a present violation, two or more acts, they haven't committed the stalking offense such that it should be enhanced.
Well, I think that was the point of Justice Process' questions. If not, it's my point. Namely, there were at least two incidents, potentially, of stalking in this case under the statute. The confrontation and whatever the first one is.
Maintaining visual contact.
Visual contact. So you had two to make up this offense. It's within 7 years of the prior offense. Guilty of I. What's the matter with that argument?
They didn't charge I. They charged H.
Sorry. Guilty of H is what I meant.
Right.
Why isn't that H? Two incidents now, so you have a violation of stalking now. Prior violation within 7 years. H.
I think that's what they intended to put on as their evidence, that she was hiding and maintaining the contact.
Okay. All right. What's the matter with that?
What's the matter with that is that then they argued to the jury and were allowed to bring in all the other 404 stuff.
So if they had done it right in your mind and not brought in all the other stuff, they could have gotten an H against your client.
Possibly.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Mays, and thank you, Mr. Weinstein, for an argument on a statutory interpretation that we may have heard before with Tums and may not have, depending on the court's view of Tums and this statute. That ends our hearing on 08AP 1296 CR State versus Janet A. Connor. And the court will meet in closed conference at 3:20. We are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45 when we will hear another three cases.